We left off last week. Is the tape on? Okay. We left off last week with a question that was raised about, from Rashi's point of view, that a Ben Noach is not permitted to take off a full day and not work. Refrain from work for a full day. Now, I mentioned to you that that's Rashi's opinion, only Rashi's opinion. The Rambam, Maimonides, doesn't learn that way, neither do most others. So, therefore, I said that Ben Noach is not obligated, really, to, strictly speaking, is not obligated to abide by Rashi's decision. Nevertheless, it is Rashi's decision is something which should be reckoned with, should be understood, and should, and also, it should be followed if possible. If a person wishes to follow Rashi, they certainly are considered virtuous, because it is, in fact, a position, and there is no real halachic decision-making after the time of the close of the Talmud. So the question was, according to Rashi, is a Ben Noach permitted? For instance, the case that you gave me was, you go to the lake and you're relaxing, you're on vacation and you're studying, but you don't do any work that day. So I gave you an introduction last week where I mentioned the rebellion of Korach. And I said Korach was a man who he came before Moses, and he stated that there's a law of mezuzah, but nevertheless, it's only to remind you of the central idea of the Torah, which is the existence of God, his oneness, love of God, and study of Torah, keeping of the mitzvahs. So those ideas are all contained in that scroll. Now, Korach said, if you have your house filled with the five books, the entire Torah, many Torahs, as a matter of fact, there wouldn't be any need to have this reminder on the doorpost. And I explained that Korach's concept was, Korach did not deny the giving of the Torah at Sinai. He couldn't. Everybody witnessed it, and he couldn't deny that Moses was the one that that God spoke to. But what he did do was come up with a different interpretation. His interpretation was that God is interested in the mitzvos philosophically, but not halachically. In other words, God does not care about the details of the of how you carry out each mitzvah. What he is concerned with is that you should be in line with the philosophical idea of the mitzvos. So if the concept is to remind you of the main ideas of the Torah, and your house is filled with the with Torahs, then you don't need a mezuzah on the door. Whereas Moses said, no, that's not true. God wants is very meticulous in the sense that he wants you to keep the mitzvah exactly the way it is, through a mezuzah. You can't use any other means. So it doesn't matter if your house is filled with holy Torahs, but the fact is you need that mezuzah on the door. That's what Moses said. And then, as you know in the story, the what took place in order to demonstrate that Moses was in line with the God, and that was that the earth swallowed up those people, and that was a demonstration from then on and forever that the Torah was given with the concept of halacha and not just philosophy. So getting back to the to our situation here with the Ben Noach, we explained, according to Rashi, that the Torah does not believe that it is good for a person to take off.
Rabbi?
Yes.
We have a question from Mr. John Miller.
Go right ahead. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Rabbi Chait, yes. In reference to a mezuzah, mm-hmm. What is the ruling for B'nai Noach? Is it permissible to place one, or is it an open decision per se that says yay or nay?
Okay, that's a good question. I could tell you, from a practical standpoint, let me just tell you what it is. It's not that simple. According to Maimonides, as I said last week, that a Ben Noach can fulfill any positive commandment. And that would mean that the Ben Noach can put on tefillin, the Ben Noach can have a mezuzah on his door, could do any commandment in the Torah. There was, however, several hundred years ago, the custom was created among the authorities that they did not permit B'nai Noach to do such things, like such as to keep mitzvos which had scrolls that were sacred, because they were concerned that the B'nai Noach would not really take proper care of those articles. Like tefillin, they have to be treated in a special way. You can't just, as a matter of fact, tefillin must be rolled up. You can't just leave them hanging around the house. And it could be a matter of experience at that time with the particular B'nai Noach that they had, that they weren't careful with these type of objects. So therefore, they determined not to encourage B'nai Noach to keep those mitzvos which have to do with sacred articles. But if you ask me, that's something that one of the authorities mentions, or a later authority. But from the halacha itself, in other words, essentially, if a ben Noach is permitted to do it, and if he does, he fulfills the mitzvah of the Torah. Now, I don't want to render any kind of decision contrary to the decision rendered before, but I would simply say that basically, Ben Noach is permitted to keep any mitzvah of the Torah. And if he does, he is rewarded for it. But as I said, the rabbis, certain rabbis, did not encourage it because they were afraid that the Ben Noach, you might have, for instance, a father that is a Ben Noach, but then his children aren't, and around the house he's going to have a pair of phylacteries, and then they won't be treated properly. They place it on the floor or not take care of it, or leave it around, just hanging around, not wrapped up properly. So therefore they did not encourage the Ben Noach to do that. That's basically what it is. Okay? Did I answer your question?
Yes, that was an adequate answer, or a good answer. Not adequate, it was a good answer. Okay, here is Martina Buchanan.
Okay, my question is, if, say, we're building a house and we put it on our doorpost, okay, what happens if we keep the laws that we keep and we want to do it on the intention, good intentions of doing this because we wanted to do a mitzvah, but we sell our house? Do we take this off, or do we take, do the people who move in, if we leave it on it, what if they don't believe anything that we believe?
Right, then you have to take it off. That's the same. You would have the same problem that a Ben Israel has when selling his house. Now, the law is like this. If a Ben Israel sells his house to another Ben Israel, so then he's not permitted to take off the mezuzah, because he's supposed to leave the next person and not let it take off. The family that moves in should really pay the, reimburse the former owner for, because they're expensive. I mean, nowadays a good mezuzah could run you, last time I took a look at it, was about $26. I understand it's even higher now, a good one. But, and that's just for one, so you can imagine an entire house could be hundreds of dollars. But technically speaking, the one who leaves is supposed to leave it on the door. You're not supposed to take it off. One of the reasons is you're not supposed to destroy an article of mitzvah. And it's a type of destruction when you separate the mezuzah from the house, because it's viewed halachically like one entity. But if a non-Jew is going to move in, you're supposed to remove the mezuzah because, as I said before, it might not be treated properly, and that wouldn't be correct. So therefore, the Ben Noach has the same exact situation as the Ben Israel in that respect. It depends who's moving in. If there's any chance that it's not going to be treated with respect, neither the person that's moving in doesn't know anything about it, and liable to discard it, just throw it in the garbage, or not watch it properly, then you must remove it. You're not permitted to leave it unless the person that's moving in knows the mitzvah of mezuzah and keeps the mitzvah of mezuzah and is careful with the mezuzah. Okay?
Okay. All right. We got another question. We're on a roll tonight.
Okay.
It's John Miller.
Rabbi, mm-hmm. This John again.
Yes, John.
Could you step us through the process and explain the attachment of the mezuzah? Are there any special blessings that have to be said? It's high for the elevation. The particulars that we would have to be aware of to kind of give us a little commonality in case some of us would like to fulfill this mitzvah?
Well, I would have to really, I'll tell you, I could do it, the only way I could do it is at the conference, because there is no mitzvah that doesn't have a lot of details. And you have to know exactly where to put it on the door, and how to put it on the door, how to roll the scroll. And blessings in general, I think you should just know one principle about it's an important principle because it has to do with what we've been speaking about all along. No blessing, and the blessings in the Torah, the blessings that that a person makes never prevent one from doing the mitzvah. What I mean, never prevent, I mean, if a person does not make a blessing, it does not nullify the mitzvah. Let me put it that way. Okay? Blessings are dispensable. That's a general rule, which means to say if the person did not make the blessing, it has nothing to do with whether you fulfill the mitzvah. There is a blessing for putting on a mezuzah on the door, but that is a separate commandment, a separate mitzvah. That's a rabbinical injunction. So if a person didn't make the blessing, it does not nullify his mezuzah. It's fine. That same thing with all the blessings. If a person, for instance, put on phylacteries and he did not make the blessing, he fulfills the mitzvah regardless. The blessing is an additional thing. It has nothing to do with the structure of the mitzvah itself. Okay, in a general way. I mean, there are specific exceptions where, you know, to this. But generally speaking, it's something you should know, that a blessing is never a part of the mitzvah. I say this because people have such a misconception about blessings in Judaism. Like people think, you know, the rabbi blesses the food, or you bless the cow before they slaughter it. It's like a total misconception, and it's really taking Christian ideas and trying to apply it to Judaism. But in the Judaic law, a blessing is always a separate entity outside of the mitzvah. It's related to the mitzvah, but if you don't do it, it doesn't nullify. It has nothing to do with the nullification or fulfillment, the actualization of the mitzvah. So there is a blessing, though, that could be said by a Ben Oel. Ben Oel could say a blessing, but the mitzvah of the Torah has nothing to do with the blessing. The mitzvah of the Torah is simply placing it on the door in the proper way. It has to be proper scroll. It should be rolled a certain way. I have to demonstrate that, and I have to show you exactly where to place it on the door. Okay, I have to measure it off. It has to be placed in a certain position at a certain height on the door. Okay? So I could do that when I come down, but it's difficult to do it over the phone. Now, getting back to the... are there any more questions?
I think we're in good shape right now. We go back to our main topic.
Okay. So getting back to the topic of the Ben Noach at the camp, when they're relaxing and not doing work according to Rashi. Now, I explained the concept of Rashi's concept, and that is, according to Rashi, the Torah maintains that, not like, I heard somebody say, what did the president do on his vacation? So the word was that he was vegging out. The Torah does not look at that as a very kindly. There's what a person, a human being, should always be doing something productive every day. And if a person is not productive, it's a wasted day. For the Ben Israel, as I said, the Ben Israel has mitzvos from the time he opens his eyes until he goes to sleep. The Ben Noach can do mitzvos, but he's not obligated to do mitzvos. Therefore, according to Rashi, the Ben Noach must be productive in a different way. And that productivity is to be part of the process of helping society and civilization, which means doing something constructive. Okay, that's some kind of work. And this is not something which is looked down upon, by the way. The Torah does not look down upon work. That concept of looking down upon work, from what I read, really came from the pagan priests, because they were the ones that felt that the priesthood did not do any work, and they were maintained, and work was looked down upon. The Torah looks up at a person that does work. As a matter of fact, the Talmud states work is a great thing because the rabbis worked, and work is a great thing because it gives honor, the Talmud says, to the one who does it. And the Talmud states that Jacob, for instance, when he came to Shechem, so he said at that time, he says, I want to be involved in, it's called helping society, maintaining tikkun olam in Hebrew. It means helping society, doing something for civilization. And that's why he, at that time, he bought a piece of field from the people of Shechem. And that was, he wanted to partake in society and doing business and in being helpful to and productive in society. So that was something which our forefather, the patriarch Jacob, did, and it's something which is considered very good for everyone, and not just the Ben Noach. But since the Ben Noach doesn't have any obligations from morning to night, so therefore his expression of being productive should be in terms of some kind of productive activity. But now your question to me was, well, what about the Ben Noach if he's studying Torah? So why should he have to be productive according to Rashi? And that's why I gave you this whole lengthy introduction. The reason is because I wanted to demonstrate to you that once a halacha is formed, in other words, once God gives a certain form of expression to an idea, we cannot deviate and say, well, we will create our own form of expression for the idea. For instance, you know very well that there's a mitzvah to eat matzah on the night of Passover, because to commemorate the Exodus and when they ate matzah when they left Egypt. Now, let's say a person will have a different way of commemorating that. He'll show a video of going out of Egypt. That would not do, because God gave the mitzvah a specific form. And that was the argument between Moses and Korach. And Moses said, no, you must have the specific mitzvah, exactly the way it is formulated. So, too, for the Ben Noach, even though a particular Ben Noach may study Torah, but you have to realize this is something which is an optional activity for him. And according to Rashi, there was a specific formula by God which states that the Ben Noach, he must be productive every day, and it was given a specific form. Now, you can understand very well why that form was given, because the Ben Israel has the obligation constantly to do all the mitzvot, whereas the Ben Noach doesn't. Now, let's say you have a particular Ben Noach who is really studying Torah. So philosophically, you'd be correct. Philosophically, he wouldn't have to do anything. But then we have the halacha, and the halacha is very specific. Now, since God gave a specific form to this concept, it means to demonstrate that a person must be productive each day, so therefore the Ben Noach must do some kind of work during that day. So it doesn't matter if the person is really studying Torah. That's very nice philosophically, but then we have to deal again with the halachic concept, and that is to keep the commandment according to the specific form that God gave it, not just according to the philosophical idea. That was Korach's concept, but we don't hold by that. So therefore, we hold by Moses, and therefore you must follow God's formula. So according, what I would say is that if a Ben Noach, and this would certainly be extremely virtuous, if a Ben Noach case where you're at the camp, I would say this much. I say that David Davis doesn't have to do anything, because that is his work. His work is to teach, and that's for him. That's his job. That's his work. So he's fulfilling his productivity, his obligation. But the other people that are present, according to Rashi, should do at least something. In other words, they shouldn't allow the day to go by without doing anything. They could do some kind of constructive activity, could mow the lawn, do some kind of activity that is productive around the house or in some way to demonstrate the concept that the Torah holds that a human being should be productive every day and should not take even one day of his life off just to lounge around and to, veg out.
Okay, I'm sorry. Rabbi.
Yes?
I've got a question for you, and Jay David's got me all upset here. You say that God gave the formula for the B'nai Noah to work every day.
Right.
Where did he give this formula at? Is it in Torah? Is it in...
Okay, that's what I was explaining to you, that it's an argument between Maimonides and most of the scholars and the scholar Rashi. According to the way Rashi interprets the oral law on verse, that day and night shall not rest, in Hebrew, it's interpreted day and night. If you look at the grammar there, it says they shall not rest. So there's an implication, according to Rashi, this is where Rashi interprets the oral law, to mean that Ben Noach should not rest for a complete day where he does absolutely nothing for 24 hours. That's Rashi's interpretation. Now, as I mentioned before, the Rashi is the only one that interprets it that way. So I say Ben Noach is not obligated to follow Rashi, since most of the other scholars interpret it differently. But if a Ben Noach wants to be extra virtuous, it would not be a crazy thing. It would be if he took upon himself to fulfill even Rashi's position, because his position, Rashi was a great scholar, and there is no real, since we don't have a Sanhedrin anymore, there's no way to come, we can't come to a real definite exclusion of Rashi's position. So, therefore, my answer is as follows, that you aren't obligated to follow Rashi's position, but if you did want to do it, that would be considered an extra virtuous activity. And the way to do that would be to make sure that you did some kind of constructive action during that day in order to demonstrate the concept that man should not just take a day out of his life where he does nothing. That this is not really proper for man to. It's not a proper philosophy. It's a philosophy that leads man away from the correct path and not towards the correct path. So it doesn't mean he has to do. He has to work for 8 hours. It doesn't even mean he has to work for 1 hour. But it would be a halachic thing that he should do some kind of activity that is constructive during that day. Some physical kind of activity that's constructive during that day. He could fix his car, he could do, you know, anything which is constructive. That would be, then he would fulfill Rashi's position. So again, let me make it clear. You don't have to fulfill Rashi's position, but if a person wanted to, that would be considered beyond, so to speak, what is required, but nevertheless not something which is meaningless. It would have a meaning for the Ben Noach, and it would be considered a fulfillment for him. Okay? So it's an optional kind of a thing. But Rashi's concept, I want you to understand that Rashi's concept, even though most do not agree with the way Rashi interprets the oral law in this case, but the concept is definitely a valid one. It's definitely, in other words, everybody agrees with it, with the philosophy of it, that the purpose of...
Rabbi Chait?
Yes.
What verse was that where you quoted in they?
Okay, hold on.
In the Torah?
Let me come over there. The verse is in Genesis. It is Genesis 8, verse 22. Okay? And, Sanhedrin. I'll show you how Rashi interprets it. Now, I have to explain something to you. And this is, I've been trying to explain this a number of times, but I know it's very difficult. But I'm going to do it again. And that is that according to Torah, you cannot. A person who does not know the methods of the oral law cannot just take a look at a verse and just say, this is what I think it means, this is what I think it doesn't mean. You have to, there's a certain amount of subordination here to the scholars of the Talmud. When a person's a scholar, he can't do that. But if they're not a scholar, their interpretation is not based on anything. It's just the way they feel that they're interpreting the law. But that's not correct. You have to go by the scholars. So I could tell you that I cannot argue on Rashi, and neither can you. This is his opinion. You can't look at that verse and just say, well, I don't think that's what the verse is talking about, because there's a system of the oral law which is a little different. It operates in its own orbit, so to speak. You have to become familiar with that. But that is Rashi's position. It's based on that verse, and I'll tell you exactly what Rashi says if you just give me a minute. Just a second. Yeah. Right. Right. He said, Rashi explains that the, you see when it says, the verse says, shall not rest. Now, at the end of the verse, do you ever have it? It says, it's speaking about the seasons over there. The open verse is speaking about the seasons. And it says that all the seasons shall not cease. I don't know what your translation is. But in Hebrew, the word is lo yishbosu. And lo yishbosu, Rashi says that the Talmud, according to Rashi, is stating that, and this, by the way, this the fact that what Rashi is saying, this is the verse, no one disagrees with that. Even Maimonides agrees that that's the verse. The only question is what the verse is referring to. Is it referring to the fact that a Ben Noach can't take a day off, or it means that a Ben Noach can't create a holiday? That's the only question. But the Talmud is, if a person wants to look it up, it's in Sanhedrin, and it's 58b, okay? And Rashi explains that it means that they should not, that they're not permitted to, that the Ben Noach is not permitted to take off a day, a complete day, from his productive activities. Okay? Now, again, this is the Talmudic interpretation of the verse because of the Hebrew phrase lo yishbosu, which means Shabbos, which Shabbos, he recognized, means a day of rest. So therefore, the Talmud explains that the term lo yishbosu is a double entendre. It means the seasons won't cease, but it also is an allusion to the halacha that a ben noach cannot keep the Shabbos. And you have to understand that, you see, I have to get more into explaining to the oral law how it works. It does not mean to say that the Talmud went through this verse, you know, and just said that this is what the verse means. The oral law is carried down from Sinai as a law separate, as a factual law separate from the verse. But there's always an allusion to every law in the Torah. And this is the allusion from the double entendre, from the use of a form of the word that has to do with Shabbos. So that's the way it works. It's a different, that's why I say it's a different kind of system. You can't just, there is the overt Bible, and then there is the covert. In other words, there is the allusions in the Torah for the oral system. But the oral system wasn't derived. In other words, a group of rabbis didn't sit down and just say, well, let's take a look at this verse. This is what it means. The oral system was carried down from Sinai, but it always is hooked in somehow. There's always a connection or an allusion to it from the Torah itself. It's not a derivation. There's a difference between a derivation and an allusion. So therefore, I understand farewell that anyone that looks at your translation, you're going to say, well, what does this have nothing to do with it? This is referring to the seasons. But that's because you're not familiar with the oral law itself and how it works. But I'm just trying to point out one thing to you, and that is it is not a derivation. Maimonides points this out, if you're interested further. Maimonides points this out in his introduction to the Mishnah. And if you get a hold of that, it's in English, too, by the way. It has been translated. If you get a hold of that, you'll see. For instance, Talmud discusses what is an esrog. You know, we use that. Those are the four species. So what is a citron? And the Talmud asks, how do we know what it is? And Maimonides explains that they weren't asking how we know what it is because everybody, they had it last year and the year before and the year before. They didn't just sit down and try to discover this. This was something which was done for centuries. But he explains that everything that we do has to have some kind of an allusion to it in the text of the Torah itself, and that's why there's all these Talmudical statements showing the allusion. So you have to derive from this verse.